From Cherokee to Currituck, from the largest city to the smallest town, and from the state house to the schoolhouse, it's Carolina Journal Radio, your weekly news magazine discussing North Carolina's most important public policy events and issues.
Welcome to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. During the next hour, Donna Martinez and I will explore some major issues affecting our state. More than 50 years in a college classroom gave one economics professor a front-row view of the problems plaguing higher education. You'll hear his prescription for restoring the promise of college. State lawmakers want to make it easier for military veterans and their spouses to work in North Carolina. You'll hear their plans to loosen occupational licensing restrictions. Before the COVID-19 pandemic, observers were already thinking about the American economy's trajectory. You'll hear one expert's assessment of the business cycle. Speaking of COVID-19, it's forcing public school students across the state to engage in online learning. We'll discuss some of the challenges of moving away from brick-and-mortar schooling. And sticking with the pandemic, Donna Martinez joins us with more on that topic. She has the Carolina Journal headline.
All North Carolina public schools are shut down, and it's much the same for many businesses, restaurants, and hotels in our state, either closed or operations severely curtailed. COVID-19, the coronavirus, has transformed life in this state and in this country in ways that we never really imagined possible. All of this challenging North Carolina lawmakers and Governor Roy Cooper to make numerous consequential decisions. Amy Cook is the CEO of the John Locke Foundation. She joins me now to talk about this very unique situation. Amy, welcome back to the show.
Hey, thank you for having me again, Donna.
The one thing that people should understand is that when elected officials and the legislature and the governor get together and they start trying to figure out how do they respond to what we're seeing in our state, they are not going to make those decisions in a vacuum. And that is because researchers here at the Locke Foundation have already put together a package of recommendations, and we hope that they'll follow those.
Absolutely. You bring up a great point. Legislators, lawmakers, elected officials, they have to make decisions about so many things on any given, you know, in a normal year, let's just say a normal year, they may have hundreds of bills to consider, which is why a resource like the Locke Foundation is so incredibly important. And we have 30 years of intellectual capital that we're now drawing on and that lawmakers can draw on. For the last 30 years, we've been providing sound public policy solutions for whatever situation elected officials have found themselves in. And right now, we're in this unique situation, as we all know. And so as lawmakers, we're trying to, you know, grapple with this. What are we going to do? The policy innovators here at the Locke Foundation went to work immediately. It was pretty amazing to watch. As the CEO, I couldn't be more proud, because I think I talked to them. We had this conversation on a Thursday, and they worked all through the weekend. So we started putting up policy solutions for them to consider the following Monday. That's how quickly they were able to turn it around. There's a couple of reasons for that. One, 30 years of providing policy solutions. So these are people who know exactly what they're doing. Also, many of the ideas that we had suggested before are things that would make it easier for government and for private businesses to deal with this crisis. Reducing regulations, especially like the certificate of need law, so that doctors and hospitals could make decisions as opposed to going to the state to get permission. There were telemedicine was another. We'd been working on telemedicine, and here it is. It is telemedicine's moment in time. So we had actually been laying that foundation for a very long time, 30 years of work, 30 years of intellectual capital. And so when this popped up, and nobody can see anything like this. Nobody expected a pandemic ever, right? But 30 years of laying the foundation of sound public policy, we were able to to put those ideas together and get them up quickly. Now, I will say the good news for North Carolina is because of some of the recommendations that the Locke Foundation had, say, over the last 10 years about responsible budgeting. Fortunately, our state, North Carolina, is in a better position financially to deal with this crisis than many other states. So we should be thanking our elected officials for being fiscally responsible in the decade prior, that we now can deal with the situation that we find ourselves in right now.
I think your point about 30 years of research and analysis of these issues is so important, because when the researchers realized that we were facing this, they didn't have to start from scratch. Many of the researchers said, okay, we know about these key areas that lawmakers are going to have to decide what to do, if anything, and we can draw upon what we already know and make some recommendations. And so it was tremendous to see that all of that work, that groundwork, was so important as North Carolina faces just historic situation here. So all of this work, of course, is available at johnlocke.org. So folks, if you would like to log on and take a look at some of these very specific recommendations, you can do that very easily.
Donna, can I add one thing to that,
sure,
too? It wasn't just that we did it for North Carolina, too. So we were ahead of the curve on, I mean, getting out there because we had that, we had all of that intellectual capital. We had already banked it. But other states looked to us, too. Other states looked at what we did and actually used our ideas for their own states. So leading in North Carolina, also leading for other states. It's just what we do. We share that information. It is out there, like you said, johnlocke.org. But it was our impact is being felt in states across the country.
And Amy, too, once we all get through this and we're back to, quote, normal, what we're hoping, of course, is that some of these issues that have now become front and center about rules and regulations and how they impede your ability to access health care and health professionals when you need it the most, things like that, and the red tape that prevents a business from being able to get out there and take care of what consumers want and need, we're hoping that some of those changes made in a time of crisis will become permanent because they simply make sense.
Absolutely, because they're just good ideas. They're great ideas. Get rid of the certificate of need. There's no reason a doctor should have to ask the state permission to get equipment that he or she knows they need to, or that they need to treat their patients. There is no reason for us not to have telemedicine. There's no reason for a patient to not be able to access another doctor across state lines through telemedicine. All of those things that are good in a crisis are just good public policy.
And not only is this a situation, though, about public policy and recommendations, but this is very personal. And Amy, you and I have talked a lot about this, along with everyone here at the Locke Foundation. Never seen anything like this. Never in my wildest dreams would I have thought that I would be facing the economic crisis that this country is facing. You know, my parents, who are now both deceased, grew up during the Depression, and they knew what it was like to not have a job, and they were dirt poor, literally, and not have something to eat. Now, we are not in that dire circumstance in this country, thank goodness, but we're facing things that many of us never could have imagined.
You know, you bring up a great point. My parents came of age in the Depression as well, and I remember when my grandmother, my dad's mom, when she died, they found what we would call hoarding today up in her attic.
Yes.
Because she said, I never want to be without again. Mm-hmm. And a personal story for me. My daughter is a hairstylist, made significant money in a high-end salon in Colorado. And she emailed me the other day, actually we were texting, said, this has been really humbling for me. All these jobs that I thought were beneath me, she said, I'm willing to do. She's a personal shopper with Instacart. She's doing hair in people's homes. She is trying to make ends meet any way she can. So we don't even know what the new normal is going to be. But what we do know is that we are having to react. And actually, for us here at the Locke Foundation, try and anticipate what is going to happen in the future so we can continue to provide those sound public policy solutions.
Amy Cook is the CEO of the John Locke Foundation. She's also the publisher of Carolina Journal. Thank you, Amy.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Much more Carolina Journal Radio to come in just a moment. Tired of fake news? Tired of reporters with political axes to grind? Well, you need to be reading Carolina Journal. Honest, uncompromising, old-school journalism you expect and you need. Even better, the monthly Carolina Journal is free to subscribers. Sign up at carolinajournal.com. You'll receive Carolina Journal newspaper in your mailbox each month. Investigations into government spending, revelations about boondoggles, who the powerful leaders are, and what they're doing in your name and with your money. We shine the light on it all with the stories and angles other outlets barely cover. But there's a bonus. Our print newspaper is published monthly, but our daily news site gives you the latest news each and every day. Log on to carolinajournal.com once, twice, even three times a day. You won't be disappointed. It's fresh news. And if you'd like a heads up on the daily news, sign up for our daily email. Do that at carolinajournal.com. Carolina Journal, rigorous, unrelenting, old school journalism. We hold government accountable for you.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. Richard Vedder has spent more than 5 decades in a college classroom, giving him plenty of opportunities to witness what's wrong with higher education. Now, the Ohio University economics professor has documented his concerns. They're compiled in the book Restoring the Promise. Vedder recently discussed the book's themes in Raleigh, speaking to the Martin Center for Academic Renewal. He joins us now to share themes from that speech. Why did you write Restoring the Promise?
Higher education has been having increasing problems. They've had problems for years, but those problems have been growing in magnitude. One statistic that was already obvious when I was starting to write the book and is even more so now is that we have nearly 2 million fewer students going to college than we did in the year 2010. So there is actually people are starting to say no to college. And, of course, the question is why? And, well, tuition fees are obviously rising dramatically. That's slowed down a little bit in the last few years, but the affordability issue has grown since my last book that I wrote on this general topic way back in 2004. We have a employability crisis of sorts. A lot of kids are getting degrees, but when they go out to get jobs, even in this hot labor market we're in right now, they get jobs. They're not unemployed, but they're often working at Starbucks or baristas, or they're working at Walmart or Home Depot or some store like that. And they're not getting jobs using the skills that are usually associated with a college degree. The last big problem is a learning problem. We don't think much about it. Are kids really learning a lot while in their college? Are they leaving with a lot more than they came in? Learning in a way that would make them better citizens, would make them more better productive workers, make them more honest, greater integrity. What is it they're getting out of college? Well, this is often very difficult to measure and very hard to measure. But what there's some little bit of evidence that says that maybe the learning is less than it should be.
Do college leaders see a problem?
I think the college community has been slow in recognizing the problem because they've been protected. They get money from state governments, they get money from private philanthropists, they get special tax breaks. They're protected. In the private economy, if you goof or make a mistake, you learn pretty quickly about it. So it's taken the higher ed community a while to realize what's going on. But now, that's what I just said is still true. A lot of very thinly endowed schools, particularly private schools, get no state money, are finding that, well, we don't we can't make it anymore. And so some of them are starting to close. Same with sort of lower quality state universities. Public support of higher ed is waning a little bit.
So, Richard Vedder, as author of Restoring the Promise, what should we do about these problems in higher education?
It's easy to criticize. It's hard. A lot of things that, in a perfect world, I could name a lot of things that should happen that probably won't happen because of the nature of the American political system. And some might say it's imperfections in our democratic process. I'm not a political scientist. I'll let others make that judgment. But there are some things that we could do. The single one thing that I think has been the biggest problem on the cost affordability front has been the federal student financial assistance programs that were put in, well, I suppose you could say they started in 1944 with a GI Bill, but didn't really become much of a factor until the 70s, the 1970s. And in the last 40 years, those have grown enormously, led to high tuition fees. Colleges have raised their fees to grab the money that is available to that they can borrow. This has caused a lot of problems, including things like this administrative bloat I mentioned. All this has come about because of high tuition fees. It wouldn't have happened otherwise, I don't think. So we got to do something to change that environment. In a perfect world, we would phase out the federal student loans. There are private solutions to the problem. When you buy a car or buy a house, you don't go to the government to buy the house. You go to someone else, and you can do the same thing with college education. We used to do it that way. Then, even now, a third or so of the people go to college even now don't borrow any money. So we need to change that. That would be where I would start.
You also recommend giving departments or even professors themselves shares of university revenue based on student enrollment.
Adam Smith in The Wealth of Nations said, well, the teaching has gone downhill at Oxford these days because now the professors are hired by the university and they get their money no matter how good of teachers they are or not. It used to be the kids, students, gave their money to the professors who then used those money to feed themselves. It was the revenue. And maybe we need to go back to you could call it an individual contractor model where professors contract with some central administration to provide their services, but where most of the fee revenue goes to the professors and then they turn around and kick some money back to the central administration to rent buildings and pay for the library and a few administrators that you really need. We have vastly too many administrators, but so, no, we need to rethink the model, that's an old, very old way of doing it. And some people look to things like online education into electronics, and there's some promise in those areas. But I think some of the old-fashioned ideas, like the one I just mentioned, also have a considerable promise.
Will the university exist as we know it 30, 40, 50 years from now?
There's probably going to be quite a bit of change. But unlike some, I do think the traditional school will exist. People go to college for a multitude of reasons. They go for socialization. They go to for the same reason people join clubs. The traditional liberal arts college or regional universities and even major state universities will exist 30, 40 years from now. There will be some changes. There will be more role for online education and for different ways of communicating. But people want to differentiate the best from the average and the mediocre. And the certification, the little piece of paper that we hand out, the diploma, is probably not the most efficient way of doing it. We kids spend $200,000 earning this little piece of paper. We'll probably find a cheaper way of doing it and a more efficient way, but we still need that certification. Kids still, the employers of the world want to know who is good and who is less good. And colleges do serve a useful role in determining that.
That's Richard Vedder, professor of economics at Ohio University and author of a book on higher education reform titled Restoring the Promise. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
If you love freedom, we've got great news to share with you. Now you can find the latest news, views, and research from conservative groups across North Carolina all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. It's one-stop shopping for North Carolina's freedom movement. At NorthCarolinaConservative.com, you'll find links to John Locke Foundation blogs on the day's news, CarolinaJournal.com reporting and quick takes, Carolina Journal radio interviews, TV interviews featuring CJ reporters and Locke Foundation analysts, opinion pieces and reports on higher education from the James G. Martin Center for Academic Renewal, commentary and polling data from the Civitas Institute, and news and views from the North Carolina Family Policy Council. That's right, all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. That's North Carolina spelled out, conservative.com. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. Try it today.
North Carolina is changing, not just day to day, but hour to hour, minute to minute, even second to second. How can you keep up with the changes, especially the ones that affect you, your family, your home, your job? Make the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal part of your social media diet. On Facebook, like the John Locke Foundation, like Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal. News, insights, and analysis you'll find nowhere else. Thanks to the experts at the John Locke Foundation, and thanks to the first-class investigative reporting of Carolina Journal. Don't wait for the morning newspaper. Don't wait for the evening news. If it's happening now, it's happening here. The John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal have you covered with up-to-the-second information. Like us on Facebook, the John Locke Foundation, and Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal.
Who knew you could shop and invest in freedom at the same time? It is true. Online shopping is now a great way to support the John Locke Foundation. Just shop using the Amazon Smile program and designate the John Locke Foundation to receive a portion of your purchase amount. That's right. You shop. Amazon donates money to us, the John Locke Foundation. Here's how. Log on to smile.amazon.com. Amazon Smile is the same Amazon you know. Same products, same prices. But here's what's better. Amazon donates 0.5% of the price of your eligible Amazon Smile purchases to the John Locke Foundation. So try it. Be sure to designate us as the nonprofit you want to support. It's that easy. So now, not only will you enjoy what you buy, you'll also support freedom. Don't forget, log on to smile.amazon.com today. Buy something nice and help defend freedom. Help support the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. Some state lawmakers want to make it easier for military spouses to get occupational licenses. The issue interests Republican State Senator Andy Wells. He asked Military Affairs Secretary Larry Hall for help.
Could you provide us with some stories about actual events that are happening to military spouses and delays in being licensed in North Carolina? Are there, I don't mean real names, but it would be nice to know, to get a picture that we can visualize on what's actually happening. So if you've had letters, emails, whatever, from spouses telling you of a bad experience, I would love to see some of those.
We have not received complaints from spouses of military that they have not been able to achieve licensure, but those would be things that would reside with appeals to the licensing boards themselves. And so until this legislation, we had not been really brought into the process to receive reports. So that's a good feature of this legislation. It now brings us into the process.
Wells questioned a proposed 30-day timeline for expedited licensing.
Is it your belief that 30 days is an expedited process?
The 30 days, I think, is the expedited process. If you take in consideration the rest of the work that the boards are probably doing, if that's a reasonable time for them to move the application, receive it, and move it through the process while they're still doing the other applications, I think that's a reasonable time. Their time on station are short, but it may be that 30 days is what you can really expect to be reasonable to get it done.
Wills explained a key reason for his concern.
When I moved into the dormant state, that was my 11th residence, so we've hit a bit of a nerve here about what happens when you have to move on a regular basis. 30 days is a long time. In government, maybe not, but in my world, 30 minutes is expedited. 3 days is reasonable. We need to talk about this.
Republican Representative John Fraley asked about spouses of military retirees.
I happen to have a constituent whose husband is recently retired military, and they've moved to North Carolina. She's formerly on the board of clinical mental health counselors in Colorado, former chair of the board out there. Has an active and valid license and is being told that she has to put in like 2,000 hours with a counselor in order to get her license in North Carolina. Now, she wouldn't fall into this because they recently retired from the military, but I'm sure if that's going on with these people is also going on in the military. It's ridiculous.
You've been listening to highlights from a recent legislative debate. It focuses on a bill to speed occupational licensing for military spouses. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
We're doubling down on freedom. At Carolina Journal Radio, we're proud to bring you stories that impact your life and your wallet. And now, get twice as much freedom when you also listen to our podcast, Headlock, available on iTunes and at johnlock.org/podcast. Now, Headlock is a little bit different. It's a no-holds-barred discussion that challenges soft-headed ideas from the left and the right. But like Carolina Journal Radio, Headlock is smart and timely. But with Headlock, you'll hear more about the culture wars, and you'll get some more humor as well. We guarantee great information and a good time. Double down with us. Listen to Carolina Journal Radio each week, and listen to Headlock, too. Remember, you can listen to Headlock at johnlock.org/podcast, or subscribe or download each week at iTunes. Carolina Journal Radio and Headlock, just what you need to stay informed and stay entertained. Both brought to you in the name of freedom by the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. Is the economy doing well? Doing poorly? How can we tell? Well, our next guest offers a perspective that's different from the ones you're likely to see on cable TV and in political press releases. He is Dr. Paul Swick, Mises Institute Fellow and BB&T Professor of Economics and Finance at the University of Mount Olive. Welcome back to the program.
Hi, it's good to be here.
You come at it from a perspective, as I mentioned, not necessarily the one that you're going to hear from the talking heads on cable TV or read in press releases or even in a lot of columns in the papers. This is one that's based on the Austrian business cycle theory. Tell us about that.
Well, the theory of the business cycle, according to the Austrians, is different than what we see in the mainstream. It has a fairly old tradition. It goes all the way back 100 years, a little bit more than 100 years. And it basically has five stages. It says that we start with an injection of credit into the system, usually through a central bank, but it can come from other places. This injection of credit will distort interest rates, which will cause entrepreneurs to behave in a manner which, well, is most typical of them. They're going to invest, but their investments aren't good investments. In fact, we call them mal investments or bad investments. Now, we don't know that at the time. That will reveal itself later. And then eventually this bubble will build. And we've seen a couple of bubbles in the last couple of business cycles. Now, as the bubble builds, it seems like times are great. We have low unemployment. We have high investment. We have high profits. Looks fantastic for everyone. But eventually the party has to come to the end and there is a crunch. Now, the crunch can take place in one of two forms, but it usually takes both forms sequentially. But it starts with the credit crisis, or it starts with a real credit crunch, but we'll have both credit and real resources being squeezed at this upper turning point. And we see that these entrepreneurs who've been doing really, really well, all of a sudden making the same mistake at roughly the same time and all in the wrong direction. And the question is why? Well, the answer is because they were fooled. They were getting the wrong signal. And these interest rates and these prices were fooling the entrepreneurs. And now it all comes crashing down in what we call a recession or a liquidation phase. And so the liquidation phase then is where the system has to reassert itself. It has to clear out all of these malinvestments, and that's a painful process. And if we're able to clear out the malinvestments and set a firm foundation, it allows us to grow, which is what we call the recovery. And so those five stages, you have the expansion, the malinvestment boom, the crunch at the top, the recession, and then finally the recovery are what constitutes the Austrian theory of the business cycle.
That is the voice of Dr. Paul Swick, who is a professor of economics and finance at the University of Mount Olive. So setting the stage with that theory of how the business cycle works, what can we tell about where things stand with the economy today?
Well, we're in a boom, right? I think it's an artificial boom. When will that upper turning point come about? Well, nobody knows. I mean, if we did, we'd be, well, very, very wealthy. That would be wonderful for us.
You wouldn't have to talk to me on the show.
Of course we'd talk to you on the show. That would be fun, right? But what we would see is that unemployment is very low right now. We have relatively low inflation. The interest rates are starting to become a little worrisome. We see the yield curve, which is looking at the different maturities. We have the short end and then we have the long end. And in a crisis, we see the short-term rates kind of spike up and they've been starting to inch up. In fact, the yield curve is fairly flat right now, which could lead to an inverted yield curve. And then 4 to 6 quarters later, typically what we see is that we're in a recession. More troubling than that, though, is input prices. And we see that input prices have been steadily rising over the last couple of years. Now, why is this a problem? Because input prices squeeze profit margins. And as profit margins get squeezed, businesses start to turn south. They start to scramble. They start to go bankrupt. And when we see an upturn in the bankruptcy of these firms, that's when we are sliding into a recession.
Given the fact that we're in a boom based on what the theory suggests and that sooner or later we're going to have this crash, what can or should we do about it?
Do you mean you and I or do you mean we as the government?
Either one, you and I and the government.
Well, first of all, if we're looking at you and I, what we want to do, what I want to do, what you should do, is to get ourselves out of debt as best as we can. So if you have credit card debt, if you have payments that are, just pay those off. Try to take advantage of the low interest rates right now. Consolidate it all, don't spend outside of your means. Right, rein it in. I know times are good right now. Don't go crazy. What about for public policy? Well, there's a couple of things that the federal government should be doing. In the monetary side, the central bank, the Federal Reserve, needs to stop printing so much money. Stop expanding the money supply because it's been out of control. Now, why? Why has that been happening? Because they have to support the spending of the federal government. The federal government has not reined in spending. We haven't seen a surplus since the 90s. It's been long overdue. We need to curtail this expansion. And you say, well, why do we have to curtail all this expansion? Well, we're running a deficit of over $1 trillion right now. We have a national debt that's $23 trillion and climbing with no end in sight. It cannot continue this way for lots of different reasons, some of which might be with China and other foreign countries. But just internally, what we want to do is we want to take care of our own house, put ourselves in financial order. And that means cutting back on the spending in all of the forms, the entitlement spending, the stuff that they call discretionary, the non-discretionary, all of it. It needs to be reined in. We're only bringing in $3.3 trillion in revenue. We're spending over $4 trillion. It's way too much. We need to bring that in.
In the brief time that we have left, people who look at the economy and say things are going along pretty well, even if they're right, something along the lines of a recession is going to be coming about in the not too distant future.
Well, it's right. And since times are good right now, we should be in this mode to get our own houses in order. It should be easier for us, both as individuals, as governments, as state governments, and as federal government, to be able to take that growth and pay down any of our debt and get ourselves on firm balance. Because once the recession hits, we will see that all of these activities will become much more difficult to do. Our creditors will be calling for us, and we will lose so much more if we don't take prudent steps today.
Prudent steps today always sounds like a good idea. That is the voice of Dr. Paul Swick, Mises Institute Fellow and BB&T Professor of Economics and Finance at the University of Mount Olive. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you. It's been fun.
We'll have more on Carolina Journal Radio in just a moment.
Real influence. You either have it or you don't. And at the John Locke Foundation, we have it. You'll find our guiding principles in many of the Freedom Forward reforms of the past decade here in North Carolina. So while others talk or complain or name call, we provide research, solutions, and hope. Our team analyzes the pressing issues of the day, jobs, healthcare, education, and more. We look for effective ways to give you more freedom, more options, more control over your life. Our goal is to transform North Carolina into a growing, thriving economic powerhouse, the envy of every other state. Our research has helped policymakers make decisions that ensure you keep more of what you earn, expand your choice of schools for your kids, widen your job opportunities, improve your access to doctors. The recipe for stability and a bright future. For truth, for freedom, for the future of North Carolina. We are the John Locke Foundation. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Donna Martinez. Governor Roy Cooper has ordered North Carolina's public schools to close until May 15th. The executive order is one element of the governor's actions in response to COVID-19, the coronavirus outbreak, of course, around the world, in our country, and here in North Carolina. Dr. Terry Stoops is Vice President for Research. He's also the Director of Education Studies for the John Locke Foundation. He joins us now to talk about the impact on school-age kids. Terry, welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
What's your reaction to this order? May 15th, schools are closed.
I think the May 15th date is actually a very good idea. There were a lot of states that have eliminated the possibility of coming back for this current school year. Some states have already declared that the 2019-2020 school year is over and that we need to start, that they need to start thinking about 2020-2021 school year. But this at least gives North Carolina an opportunity to resume the school year if we find that conditions improve rapidly through April and into May. So it's always something that can be revised later. But I think Governor Cooper was very smart in listening to the State Board of Education, the Department of Public Instruction, and their recommendations that May 15th be the date the schools would resume for now.
We say closed. closed in terms of in-person attendance. Things are moving online?
Yeah, and it's complicated because the schools, some schools are open providing meal service for families that don't have access to food. So they're technically kind of open for them, but for the most part, most instruction has gone online. But to be honest, it's very uneven. There are some teachers that jumped right online and have students working on assignments that they had planned for those students for months. There are some teachers that are now just getting things posted online and starting to communicate with parents. And as the father of two school-aged children, I could tell you that there are some teachers that are already on the ball and have assignments in the students' hands and due dates already planned for those assignments. And there are other teachers that just haven't sent the kids a thing, except maybe a message saying that they're working on it to suspect or to expect something down the road.
That's fascinating. Is the inconsistency from county to county, or is this within county systems there's an inconsistency?
It's from classroom to classroom.
Oh,
and what we're finding is that there are some teachers that are well-equipped for doing this, and there are some subjects that seem to work very well online. I think math is one subject that can be easily transferred to an online format. There are other teachers that are really struggling with this, and there are school districts struggling with how to treat these days, because there's a debate about whether these are legitimate school days or that they will need to be made up. Some teachers are taking attendance, some are not. Some are grading assignments, some are not. So you find a huge amount of variation across the state in what students are being required to do right now and what schools are expecting of them.
What role then would the school principal play? Wouldn't it be just common sense that a principal would say, okay, to all of my teachers, you have to do X, Y, and Z by this date, and you have to do A, B, C by this date?
This is a classic case of passing the buck. The principal says that they're waiting for guidance from the superintendent. The superintendent is saying that they're waiting for guidance from state education officials. State education officials say they're waiting for guidance from the federal government. That's all kind of true. There is a lack of information being circulated right now, and certainly one can argue a lack of leadership. One of the outstanding issues that a lot of people are thinking about right now is what to do about students that are entitled to special education services. This is enforced by federal law, where students must receive these services, and school districts are liable if these kids do not receive the modifications to their education as outlined in an individualized education plan. It's a very serious matter if you violate an individualized education plan. And we've heard mixed messages from the Department of Education in Washington, D.C. as to whether providing an online education does or does not meet the requirements of special education law.
Well, Terry, if there are some teachers doing things one way and actually doing something and engaging their students, and other teachers are behind. Some are grading, some are testing, some are not. What does that mean going forward? How would we know at the end of the traditional school year if a child is ready to move on?
We won't, because a state testing will have been canceled. And so any sort of assessment that we would have of student achievement has been eliminated. So we will have no idea whether they're ready to move on or not. Now, it may be sensible for us to eliminate testing. And I think it probably is a good idea, because we wouldn't fare very well with schools being closed right now. But we really have no reliable way of knowing if students are ready for the next grade. And we have a lot of questions that we're going to need to answer this summer as to whether kids are going to be in summer school. If they are, how are we going to pay for the summer school? How are we going to deal with the fact that our school calendar requires the school year to start on the Monday at earliest, the Monday closest to August 26th, when we may want kids to start school earlier to catch up for what they missed? There are so many moving pieces in this that have to do with federal, state law, and local education practice that we will not know for sure until we get the all clear and schools open back up.
What about high school seniors? How will we know if a high school senior has indeed completed the coursework required to receive a high school diploma in North Carolina?
Well, some of the recommendations are that they would receive credit for the work that they have done already, and their grades as of the day of closure would be their final grade. Of course, this leaves all kind of open questions of things like, what do you do with advanced placement courses? Students that have been preparing all year to take the advanced placement test in order to get college credit for the course now has to face the prospect of not being as prepared for the advanced placement course as they could have been. Now, the AP has announced that they would eliminate some of the questions on the test to level the playing field for students to be able to take the AP class, take the AP test in order to receive that credit. But these are just the questions that many schools and states are struggling to answer right now, and proposals are swirling back and forth from state education officials and lawmakers as to how to ensure that those students can successfully complete the school year and move on to either post-secondary education or the workplace.
You're making my hair hurt just as we talk about this, because it just seems so scattered. And granted, this is unprecedented. So you can't really realistically expect that there would be a, quote, plan in place for everyone to be able to just transition overnight to online learning. But Terry, what is your biggest concern now? I mean, you are a former teacher. You actually are a founder of a public charter school in Wake County. What's your biggest concern?
Really, my biggest concern is those students right now that are in courses that will be tested and tested next year. In other words, those foundational courses that they will need to be successful going forward. My oldest is a high school freshman taking Math 1 and is missing a significant amount of instruction in Math 1. And so the question will be, how will he be successful in Math 2? Those are the biggest concerns I have right now.
Dr. Terry Stoops is the Vice President for Research, the Director of Education Studies for the John Locke Foundation. Terry, thank you.
Thank you.
That's all the time we have for the program. Thank you for listening. On behalf of Mitch Kokai, I'm Donna Martinez. Join us next week for another edition of Carolina Journal Radio.
Carolina Journal Radio is a program of the John Locke Foundation. To learn more about the John Locke Foundation, including donations that support programs like Carolina Journal Radio, send email to development@johnlocke.org or call 1-866-JLF-INFO. That's 1-866-553-4636.
Carolina Journal Radio is a co-production of the John Locke Foundation, North Carolina's free market think tank, and Carolina Broadcasting System, Incorporated. All opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of advertisers or the station. For more information about the show or other programs and services of the John Locke Foundation, visit johnlocke.org or call us toll-free at 866-JLF-INFO. We'd like to thank our wonderful radio affiliates across North Carolina and our sponsors. From all of us at Carolina Journal Radio, thank you for listening, and please join us again next week.